any offers.
I'm going to ask you about the word trance. Mm-hmm. It comes a lot in yoga and the sort of ESP phenomenon. I was trying to see exactly what it was, because it's obviously a movement towards something from the word trance. In some ways it seems to be a state of heightened consciousness, and in some states it seems to be a state of lower consciousness. I wondered if it meant that state when you shut off all the fire organs, but you haven't gone to sleep and you are not immersed in memories. I've been trying to get that, just exactly what it was.
Well, we could say roughly to begin with, it's a state in which one transcends something without saying what the thing is. Particularly, we can say that when you transcend any waking level state, that you are in some measure in trance. We can say trance, if you like, is shorthand for transcendent state of consciousness. But you can't transcend nothing, you transcend something. Let's draw a bead now. This is a self-portrait, so I must make sure that my tail is well in the mouth. Seems to be a bit of duality in the tail there. That's probably the paradox. Or a bent pencil or something. Now, every being is a modality of an absolute non-dual force. This force is sentient. That is, it can count and it can feel. It counts its own modalities. It feels their relative pressures. We like to put another line swinging in to remind us it derives from transcendence, universal transcendence. That would be the level outside the circle that a man would reach if he were to transcend the universal. He would be in a trance in which the object transcended would be the whole universe. Now the force coming into the universe spins round, and every spin it makes is a being. Every subsidiary spin, every sub-cycle, is also a being. We've gone filling in all the cycles with smaller ones. And every time we make a cycle, we've made a finite being. We've locked up a certain amount of intelligent power, sentient, counting and feeling power. Now, identification occurs whenever the sentient power superstresses a given form. So if this sentient power rotates around here, and in this subcircle, which we could call a circle of the second order, using the first one we do as the universal first order logos, and the second order circle, and the third order circle within it. If the intelligent power in that place vibrates this second order circle very intensely, so that the intensity of its vibration becomes greater than that of the first circle, and then that of the internal circle, we can then say there has arisen an individuated consciousness which is felt as an egoic consciousness at that place. If we then have this intelligent power superstressing a subsidiary circle, the circle of the third order within it, till it reaches intensity big enough relatively to demand the service on this sentient power, in other words, it is the most intense vibration in that zone, then we will say that the consciousness is identified with the circle of the third order. Now, supposing over a long period of time this identification of the circle of the third order proceeds, so that habitually in that zone there is a superstress of that kind, and that we call the continuous existence of the individual. Now, after a time, through certain stimuli hitting this super stressed one. The super stressing is now interfering with that incoming stimulus energy. For a moment, the identity of the being is modified by the incoming stimulus. Supposing the stimulus is characterized by a motion that says, I come from outside the circle of the third order. For that moment, there is a complex state of consciousness. There's the original third order stress plus an intense stimulus from outside saying there are circles beyond you. For a brief moment, the moment of the duration of the stimulus, the being transcends the merely third order level. At that moment, he's gone into a trance, even if it only operates for a second. But normally, we wouldn't say of a person, he is in a trance. If he goes into it for a second, he comes out of it. Usually, because we are so busy in trance ourselves and something else, that we haven't enough energy left to make the observation. And if we get a group of these things superstressed within a given circle, so that the superstressed ones are all about the same level, they constitute a social organization, and they are all at the level at which they can communicate, because their intensities of vibrations are roughly similar. If one of them now, receiving a stimulus from outside, begins to behave in a peculiar manner that the others cannot understand, then they will say, he is in trance. He is peculiar. Something's got hold of him. Something outside our understanding is now gripping him. If his body then becomes relatively slow in motion, slows down, becomes quiescent. If he stands still and doesn't move, like Socrates on occasion stood all day and night in bare feet, meditating, then the others looking at him said he is in a state transcending the usual state we know him in. He is in a trance state. Now, if we let this circle represent any given individual and we retain this definition of it, the trance is a state of transcendence, we can see immediately that any given being can be in a state of transcendence in one part of his being, whilst in another part of his being he is in contact with a particular order, say the social order. This is again the same thing as the doctrine of sevens. If we take this circle as a man, and the big circle is the feeling level, and the second order circle is his ideational level, and the third order one is the impulse level, by arranging a certain number of stimuli upon him, we can bring into consciousness his feeling level, or his rational level, or his impulse energy level. When we do so, we are causing the consciousness in that place to be presented with different forms of activity. If we stimulate a person so that he goes out of phase, out of contact with other beings in society, they will decide that he is now transcendent of their level. If he keeps himself relatively immobile during it, it will correspond roughly with what people mean by a trance state when a medium goes in trance. This means that one man can be simultaneously in trance in bits, transcending certain ideas, and in some other bits he may not be. Very often you'll get a conversation between two people where a superstressed concept in one is broadcasting through space, being received by a superstress in another, so that he is aware of the message, he gets the message. Simultaneously, another thing, characterized quite differently in this receiving being, is broadcasting another one, which is being received by a third being. Now, if we call them A, B, and C, A is broadcasting a certain message, B is receiving it and broadcasting another message to C. C is not receiving A's message. This is the kind of thing that goes on in a conversation between three people where one keeps winking to another one because the other one hasn't got the message. And the same thing goes on inside any individual man. Particular ideas light up when the stimulus hits them, communicate with other ideas in the same mind, and a third idea gets a message which the first one hasn't sent, and the second one has. And there's a mutual winking going on. So we actually find when we're watching the expression of a person, and we give certain stimuli, that a fleeting, cunning smile will appear on the face and then disappear. And the person himself, if asked, says he hasn't smiled. By he is referring to one of the larger circles. The smiler was a small one. He was identified with the larger. The stimulus hit the smaller and heightened it. So to some end, suddenly realize that he had a bit of power in the situation, releases a bit, and a smile occurs. Any given person is traversed, as we've said before, by all the motions of the action. These motions are producing a reaction in every being, so that every being is broadcast to every other being, its own peculiar attitude or reaction level to the absolute motion. And the particular reactions to the absolute produced by these finites produce mutual interferences at a particular level. Now, supposing we let this represent a human being, and inside this human being there are eggs. The eggs in the human being that are going to become children, if they get an opportunity, are of the same protoplasm, the same irritable substance. Irritable substance means substance with the power to react to a stimulus. And they're the same as the body in which they live, and they've only been parted, not severed, by a dynamic process, an action of power and modulation. Now, supposing this large circle represents the parent body, we say in this case the mother, a stimulus comes out from outside, hits the mother, and the vibration goes through the mother's substance. Because this substance of the eggs he is carrying is the same substance, therefore the stimulus motion goes and influences the egg carried. This is why we can do factually a very peculiar thing about any born being. We take a human being, we can chase a human being back prior to conception, if we wish. We can actually locate it as an egg in the mother's ovary. We can chase the form back into the father and the will back into the mother. And we can get a response from it, because every word ever spoken by the mother has vibrated the mother's substance and has been engrammed on the substance of all the organism. That includes the eggs. So that every egg is already furnished with the experiential pattern of the mother, and so on backwards to the original Adam. If we then give the appropriate stimulus to a given being, we can, by selecting the stimulus and the strength of it and the duration of it, bring into consciousness any level of being at all, whether from birth or from conception or prior to this. In this way, we can find particular determinants. Now, there is a thing called biological time. Philosophers know about it, and scientists know about it, and today study it. There is time on the clock, which we measure arbitrarily by a hand going around the face, and we coordinate this with the Earth spinning on its axis, and this with the Earth going around the Sun. There is also, apart from the arbitrary clock time that we use, biological time. Now, biological time is the time of life impulses. Let's imagine a plant to grow. We have a seed down there. It is put into the earth dry. The soil around it has a certain amount of dampness in it. The dampness soaks into the seed, and the seed begins to swell. The energy of the sun strikes into the ground, and the formative power invested in the field of the seed, not in the gross mass of the seed, now begins to resonate through the sun's energy animating it and the releasing effect of the dampness from around about. For every energy impulse from the sun, a and from the moisture imbibed, it grows a little bit. So it grows a certain distance in space for a certain amount of time as the earth rotates on its axis. The plant is pushing up, and it pushes up through alternations of night and day. So if we examine a plant carefully, we will actually find that it grows in impulses. Throughout the day it grows, and in the night it will rest a bit. And then a process is taking on activity in the night that are not occurring in the day. And then a process is that occur in the day and don't occur in the night. But for every distance that the shoot pushes, the earth is rotated a bit. So there's a relation between our clock time and the biological time. The biological time is the distance grown when a given energy impulse in it pushes the material derived by photosynthesis from the sun and from chemistry in the soil. It pushes a definite amount of matter, a definite distance, in a definite amount of time. Time is emit backwards. Energy emissions are biological time. There is a formal change then in biological time, whereas in the arbitrary time of man measured on the clock face, the finger just keeps going round and round and round, and apart from wearing out, the clock doesn't change. Whereas in biological time, every impulse, every movement, like the finger of the clock, instead of remaining the same, changes the form. So that it takes a definite number of rotations of the earth, a definite amount of energy for the sun, a definite amount of moisture and chemistry in the soil, for a tree to reach a certain height. And exactly in the same way, a human being, from the egg, right through to whatever age it reaches at death, is growing and changing in its form. And because of the earth's position in the solar system, and going round, we have a record in the egg, which is made by the conditions of the solar forces and the sidereal forces, those from the stars, and any planetary forces that are, and these all intersect in the egg. And the egg is growing. That egg is going to push itself up and make a head. Little buds are appearing that make arms and legs. Further little buds appear that make fingers and toes. And so on, the eye develops, the spine develops. Every moment of development is made in a definite moment of time, and in that moment of time there's a definite configuration of forces. So that for every formal stage that we have in our bodies, there is also recorded in the same tissue the balance of forces which are the objective result of all the forces in the sidereal, solar and planetary system. Consequently, we find that any given being at any age of his life has a system of records inside, which normally do not operate totally, but they operate according to the nature of the prevailing stimulus. When a certain thing has happened, and the moon was full, to keep the case very simple, and just use the moon, if a certain incident happened and the moon was full, then when the moon changes phase, that incident will tend to lapse from consciousness. And when the moon becomes full again, the conditions in relation to the moon will be repeated. And when the conditions are identical, the same kind of consciousness arises again. In this way we find that all the forces, and the stars, and the sun, and the planets, are intersecting any given being. All the forces of hereditaments, the whole of the human race, the whole of the vibrations of the protoplasm of the original egg that split, are all impinging on one being. But what determines the particular mental content and feeling content and physical action tendency of any given being is the sum total of its records from all these sources, plus the stimulus value that hits it at the moment. The stimulus has power to cause stepping up of the record inside. In other words, the stimulus selects by its character from the whole protoplasmic record some particulars which it then brings up, makes them more intense, superstresses, they then dominate consciousness. And if you prod the individual with another stimulus, what are you thinking about? He will reply so and so. If he's identified with it and doesn't understand the mechanics of it, he will think that he is thinking because he wants to. In fact, the thinking is occurring because of the total records within and the quality of the external stimulus. Now, until we get control of the records or of the stimulus or of both, we cannot determine completely our mental content. Let's see whether this is not logically true. We draw a circle to represent any being whatever. In the centre of this circle, we put immanent spirit, IS. That immanent spirit is flowing out. It flows out from eternality, from infinity. It's flowing towards a perimeter. From outside comes a stimulus which hits it. The characteristic of the immanent spirit energy is always to formulate as it comes out. Spirit is an intelligent formulating power. It is creative, means it is formulative. Its natural tendency is to formulate. The incoming stimulus here imposes from outside by the contingent flesh of finites a modification of the spiritual form that's springing up from the center. Between the zone of immanent spirit and the perimeter of the body is the action band. The action band is full of action determined by the external stimulus and the internal formulative energy springing up. There is nothing in the being other than that which the being sends from its own center outwards, and that which an external stimulus puts in as a modifier. In the center of every being, the immanent spirit is essentially positive. It is the only absolute real. It has no negativity in it whatever. It is essentially joyful, essentially happy. It has no misery, no unhappiness. And therefore, we have to look for the cause of misery, of unhappiness, and so on, somewhere other than the immanent spirit in the center. We look for it and we find that all the beings that exist have a center with immanent spirit in it, and therefore they're all essentially positive. We have to find a cause of a negative, and the only possible cause when they're all internally necessarily positive is the contingent relation. One strikes against another. A disturbance from one center, quite positive, impinges on the motion of another center, quite positive, and the two motions mix together and interfere. This interference is the original of the negating principle. The immanent spirit in one place can decide to shout A. The immanent spirit from the other will shout B. One says A across the intervening space. One says B across the intervening space. A finds that although A is coming out of its centre very clearly, on the perimeter it keeps hearing B. B finds from its centre B is springing out. On the perimeter it hears A. It knows that it hasn't said A, it is saying B. So it knows there is an external B because something is being said which it is not saying. And this is our proof that other beings exist. Because when we say something or do something, we find something else is being said and done too, which we didn't initiate. If a third being happens to get between the two, and is trying to be a yogi and sit down quietly, it will find that its space of meditation is traversed by sounds shouting A and shouting B. It may then find that its meditation is hard to hold. Unless it gets the power to transcend A and B, by setting up another concept, not A, not B, so the motion of A is negated right on its entrance, the motion of B is negated on its entrance, it cannot meditate in quietness. It can, if it likes, allow A and B to enter and set up inside it another concept, C, concentration. Whatever characteristic motion it sets up, so intensely that the others relatively lax, will give it the power to concentrate. every being that exists is in exactly the same position. It is receiving stimulation from outside. It is sending from its own center, formative, intelligent spirit. We can do a series of experiments, if we can find some volunteers, to demonstrate that this actually goes on. A man with his five senses records in his five sense mind, which we call the external empirical mind, those things that have come from outside. Inside him he has an intellect. The function of that intellect is to judge in terms of pairs of opposites everything presented to it and to formulate what the inner spirit says and make it applicable for the external world. The mind, the organ of the five senses, is the one that people use from day to day. If we want to know what the immanent spirit is saying, and we use any terms at all that refer only to the five sense mind, the external empirical mind, we won't get a response. So if we use the word remember, in ordinary parlance it means conjure up again a message from the five sense recording. We have other words that we can use which will allow us to conjure things from inside here. We can conjure from any level because of our fact of biological time and the fact that every finite being is traversed by energies, and that all the energies are recording, and all the intersections at periods of growth of recording on those interference patterns, so that any interference pattern can re-stimulate an original memory. Knowing this fact, we can formulate particular orders of stimuli which can conjure up things that the empirical intellect can't get at. Long term, really. The empirical mind, the five sense mind, we should reserve the intellect for this internal circle. Now, every man is conditioned by the incoming stimuli. These, in general, in ordinary life, are so strong that they produce a continuous reflection against the inner circle where the immanent spirit is and bounce back into the external world. Every stimulus from outside goes in to a certain distance. It cannot go into the immanent spirit because, we remember, the force rotating and contracting can't go to the dead center. If it did, it would stop rotating. So it goes into the innermost rotation band and bounces off it and comes out again. Stimulus energy goes in, hits onto the protective band, that's the fiery sword keeping you out from the Garden of Eden, that rotation of high speed energy around the immanent spirit. It hits against that, comes out. It was modified a bit by the state of the substance going in. It frequently doesn't come out on the same track, but on another track. When you put a stimulus in the ear and it comes out on the tongue. So it's characterized on the way in, passing through the substance, by the recorded forms on the in flow. It is further characterized on the way out, and therefore when it does come out, it's a highly complex reaction system. If we try to get any sense out of this at all by putting a stimulus in, and the stimulus only relates to the five sense line, it won't go further than the five sense record and will then bounce out and always give you an externally significant remark. It will never give you a spiritual reply. We can't know what this means unless we submit to it. This is why we need volunteers, in fact. We'll possibly get a volunteer later. Let's see if we've got any courageous fellows here tonight. We will shoot a stimulus at the being of the empirical sense order, such as I will say, let us look at the light here suspended, the light bulb. Now, when I take the light bulb, the stimulus goes in through the ear to an empirical reference, the light bulb. But if I say, let us look at the light, it doesn't go into the same source. As soon as we've said light bulb, we've triggered off a certain empirical five sense complex. To do with a glass thing, with a metal piece, and you bung in a socket before you switch on, so that the form of the stimulus will condition the form of the reaction. If we get somebody to reply spontaneously when we give a certain word trigger, we will find that if we say, let us look at the light bulb, the mind immediately focuses on the bulb as a material object, and therefore we have no transcendence of that particular. And if we want to get a transcendent consciousness, transcending the empirical, we will start turning the particular gross material into a general and then into a universal, and we will do this by taking off the particular characteristics. Thus, there is electric light, candle light, paraffin lamp light, light in a woman's eyes, and so on. All these are light. Now, let us contemplate light. As soon as we say this, the consciousness begins to diffuse. And if we say, we don't want to diffuse the consciousness, let us consider the light of a match. An ordinary match made of wood with a sulfur compound tip. When we think of this piece of wood, we finite the mind, and we are then losing the transcendence we have. If we then say, that match used to be called a Lucifer, Lucifer already has resonance with a certain mythical character. Supposing we say it was called a Lucifer because of its tendency to incandesce when you strike it or irritate it. And it refers to it being a long time ago, and the great compression produced a gross material body, and then by further compression caused it to incandesce and generated a sun. This is Lucifer, the light bearer. The moment we do this, we cause the arising in consciousness of certain mythic symbols, a widening, a deepening, and a heightening of awareness. If we say this to a child who's never heard of Lucifer in his terrestrial existence from the point of birth, nevertheless, we won't get the same response from him that we would if we said, take a match from a pup box. Because although he thinks as an individual of, say, 5 years old, that he's never heard of this character Lucifer or the myth, nevertheless, his substance is actually traversed by Lucifer as heard by all the protoplasm throughout the whole of the human race, and especially that from which he derived. So if his father ever said Lucifer and knew that it meant a certain mythic character, then the child has recorded in him, no matter how vaguely, a transcendent image, that is an image that goes beyond the particular empirical figure of a match for lighting a cigarette. Now, because of this fact, we can cause the arising in consciousness of factors that we cannot contact by any empirical method. We can utter words which go in the mind, we can find particular resonances in a body, and we can cause the arising in that mind, in that body, of certain contents which the individual owner of the body cannot, by the use of his reason of the empirical order, rouse. If a man tries, after reading a book for the first time on how to be a yogi or something, if he tries to understand the book in terms of what he thinks he knows, and what he thinks he knows is only empirical, he will reduce the significance of the book down to his own level. Which is why all the great yoga teachings say, it is not for us to simplify the teaching, it is for the pupil to climb up to our level. So if we get a particular book on yoga called A Handy Pocket Guide to Yoga by Fal Shan, usually well in six, we will find that it promises to simplify, to popularize, and to make available for all men absolute consciousness, omnipotence, and all your own way. This is a direct appeal to the empirical mind, like certain American advertised religions that tell you that scientific prayer can give you a student maker. They are an immediate appeal to your empirical self, and all they produce is a reaction from the group of concepts called empirical self to start reading the book. But because it was that group of concepts, the book cannot possibly be understood. I know certainly Nick was very natural and usual. She's ambitious, she's grasping, she's greedy. She gets a little book from America that tells her how to pray scientifically. It says, you look through a magazine until a coloured picture catches your eye and you like what it represents. Like certain American advertised religions that tell you that scientific prayer can give you a Studebaker. They are an immediate appeal to your empirical self. And all they produce is a reaction from the group of concepts called empirical self to start reading the book. But because it was that group of concepts, the book cannot possibly be understood. I know certainly Nick was very natural and usual. She's ambitious, she's grasping, she's greedy. She gets a little book from America that tells her how to pray scientifically. It says, you look through a magazine until a coloured picture catches your eye and you like what it represents. You cut it out, you stick it on the wall, and you write underneath it, this will be mine in 3 weeks. She cut out a coffin she saw in the country. She stuck it on the wall. Well, she'd been told that God was omnipotent, omniscient. All wealth was his. So the next day she saw, besides the place where she'd cut the cutters from the newspaper, a beautiful dish, pirates, who would cook things. So she cut that out as well and stuck it on the map. After 6 months, she had a very large wall space covered in all the things that she was going to get. And they were all coming. Now, because she'd been appealed to on the empirical level, nothing happened. So she decided that she had committed a secret sin, and that the force of God was trying to stop her getting these things because she had committed a secret sin. Now, of course, she had committed a secret sin. It was secret from her, and it was a sin. Sin means missing the mark, and she didn't know where she'd missed it, how she'd missed it. So she had committed a secret sin. When it was explained to her that it was no good provoking the empirical self to be materially ambitious, unless you intended to make the said empirical self go out and scrub offices to get the money. Somehow, if you appeal to the gross material self and set it going, it will have to use a gross material means. If you can appeal to the rational self, it will use a rational means to get what it wants. If you appeal to immanent spirit, that can reverberate throughout space and get what it wants. Whether what it wants corresponds to what the empirical self wants has to be examined very, very carefully. The fact is that if you correctly formulate the stimulus, you will get the results. If you stimulate the empirical mind, it will work for you empirically. If you stimulate the pure intellect, it will work for you logically. And it will explain to you the paradoxical nature of why you can't get your own way. If you go into the immanent spirit and you happen to agree with what it says, lo, it is already moving in that direction before you start talking. All you can do, really, when you see it, is agree with it. But certainly you can get a response. The response that things are going quite well, thank you. And if you'd like to jump into the bandwagon, you can do so. And if you don't, you can go back to using your logical faculty like a good angel, or you can go back to your empirical body, like a block of stone. The important thing to realize is that by means of words, as we said before, you have a system of symbols which can stimulate any content whatever that is inside your body. Let's pretend for a moment here is a man. This man has 3 parts. They overlap. The top part is thinking, the middle part is feeling, and the bottom part is energy. Now, they overlap a bit because the energies from the edge department flow out, and they flow over the edge of the energies from the feeling department. And these flow over the edge of the ideational department. And the ideational emotions flow down also to the will department, and the will floods up over the ideational department. Nevertheless, we have these 3 centers. Here is a man. Supposing we say that a man has in his head, generally, from his social training, a number of ideas grouped together on the moral concept. All these ideas are really negations of the primary will. They all say you can't do that there, you, if you can do it at all. Down below, the urge coming from the primary reproductive force of God the Father, because he is absolutely the only producer, that urge coming through a human being climbs up and sends a message, time to have a baby. Now, the message, when it gets up, may come when the man is in a cafe. The girl who comes in, who is very beautiful, of course, has been the occasion whereby the energy of God the Father says, that is worth reproducing. We could do with another of those. But it doesn't happen at least to a man. So, as he looks at her, and as God the Father says, thou shalt reproduce and cover the earth with thy kind and pick a good one when you're at it, this moral training says, you can't do that. She's not yours. So, the energy rising up is forced down. And when it's forced down, if it gets forced too low, it begins to impede the action of this generative force. Now, apart from reproduction, this same energy below has to digest your food for you. The same energy, which is concerned with reproduction, is also concerned with digesting your food. Because the command is that you shall eat the toil from the ground, you shall bring forth in tears, etc. So eating and reproducing are very, very closely intertwined. So if this positive energy, which procreates, not only physically, but procreates good ideas and good feelings and so on, if it gets stopped by any negative idea from above, derived from a contingent social relation, it is interfered with. At that moment, it feels depressed. We actually feel this first in the cerebral plexus. If you feel in your body, you will find a drop, a feeling of real depression physically, a pull down, when a negative from the mind presses down and says, you can't do that. The battles that go on in civilized men largely go on in the region of the stomach and cerebral plexus. So, simply because in the civilized state, an engaging stimuli of social taboos is concerned to inhibit the free creative activities that spring from below. Until we can understand the permissibles and the not permissibles clearly and see why a certain thing is bad, if it is, and to see whether it's bad in a given time or place, or merely just bad all the time, until we can do this, we will continuously operate upon our creative energy and stop it working. We have one primary drive, always positive. All it wants to do is reproduce pretty things, clever things, strong things, beautiful things, harmonious things. Whatever is worth reproducing, that thing wants to reproduce. It is working universally through particulars. The universal works through particulars. What comes through the particulars is a universal characterized by the form of the receiving being. So the energy coming through being universal has no regard whatever for the social taboos that have been imposed in contingent relations. Consequently, it continuously tries to overthrow them. And as soon as these creative energies rise up in one man and begin to express themselves, on the gross material level, it becomes apparent to other men with gross bodies that if he is not stopped, he's going to fill the place with delightful creations on which no doubt he will write his name. Now, all the other finite beings are very busy writing their names also, so they all connive to inhibit the creative one. This is why when Christ is born, immediately the news goes out, he is born, all the negating forces of social structures come down upon him and say, we must kill him quickly. Because the immanent spirit is continuously creating, and behold, I make all things new, it says. Now, if you've got a vested interest in something old, you don't want something new to be made. Consequently, the new force that makes all things new must somehow be killed by the social force. Herod Herod is a hierarchical force which is dividing people into bits. And this procreative force transcends all boundaries, and therefore it cuts right through all the social strata, and it overthrows all the things that the gross material hierarchs want to impose. Consequently, there's a continuous battle going on between this creative energy and this negating energy of the gross material hierarchs. The battle rages somewhere between these two. If the man knows enough and has sensitive feeling enough, then he can balance the battle very carefully on the region of the heart. If the negative forces force it below the heart level, the first thing you'll get is a sensation of loss in the solar plexus. If the negative forces push below the solar plexus, you'll find that the sensation of loss goes deeper in the pit of the stomach. If it pushes further, it will go in your navel. If it pushes further still, it will go right down and make you impotent. If it does that, the full capacity of the negative force to deal, the person will become apathetic and then he will die. If, on the other hand, these forces from below rise up above the heart, it becomes apparent to the social man, and that is a complex of social taboos inside him. The social man is a complex of social taboos. It becomes apparent to him that he is about to be disrupted. Now he immediately panics. The first sign is a movement in the thyroid. Something's going around the base of your neck. It's fluttering. If this characterized man, the social man, remember he's only a complex of social taboos, if he's not strong enough to knock this creative force back again, the force rises up, climbs up into his head, quite suddenly he hears antisocial thoughts very strong. If he can't inhibit them, he will start speaking. If he does speak them, then all the contingent beings at the social level will jump upon him and define him as crackers. They will say he is socially not fit to be let loose. He is uttering strange things. The fact that people get locked up in mental hospitals doesn't mean that there is no substance, no sense in what they say. It simply means that the social forces acting upon them find them uncomfortable to live with. It doesn't matter how mad you are, providing your external behavior and conversation gives no hint of it. On the other hand, it doesn't matter how sane you are, if what you say contradicts the social taboo. And then the more strongly the truth is presented, which contradicts that social taboo, the more crazy you are, and the more contingent reaction you will provoke. So if we take any given man, and he has inside himself a sense of loss somewhere around the tummy, as soon as he gets it, his first duty to himself is to say, at what particular point did this sensation arise? He must trace back, there's a technique whereby you can do this, slide back in consciousness until that sensation disappears and see what he's thinking about, and then he must come forward again and see what he's thinking. At a particular critical point, you will find that a certain idea appeared in the mind, and that this idea said you can't do that, and clamped down on what in fact is a creative urge. So by sliding about and watching the changes in your own mind, every time your mood changes, you will find there has been a trigger for it. Let's draw a simple vision. With no moods at all. Mood, apart from looking like a cow, and being divided, and spelling doom backwards. Mood means that the substance is dominating the situation and is being divided. If you identify with the substance, you are in a mood. If you identify with imminent spirit, you're not in a mood. You'll probably be in a hood, which you should wear, called a Persian bonnet. Actually, it should look like this, of course. You find this in a lot of mythical carvings and so on. There's a fundamental vomit, like disappointed vomit, chronic vomit. And it symbolizes that a man is transcending the mood. It has various phallic references, but phallic references are considerably lower than the real reference, because its real reference is contained in this fact, that this point spreads down and covers. He's a hooded man, not a moody man. The original of the pool's cap. It also is called by another name in mythology, and you will find certain Persian gentlemen wearing it. And you'll find a certain race, one of the biggest nuisances the world has ever known, wearing this same cap. This cap means transcendence, and it's just like a compass, and you spin it round, and circumscribes the situation.
Which is always
all from the same source. Now, the moon means that substance is determined, and that is not free spirit. Substance is mass inertia. If we don't draw anything in the circle, we draw ourselves a circle with nothing in it, that is not moved. And if we fill the circle in with motion, and this motion characteristic continues, that is moved. So a moody person is a person determined by the substantial state of his being. Whereas the opposite, a hoody person, like Houdini, is a person who has seen the danger of substantial identification, so he refuses to identify with the substance. He moves backwards to the immanent spirit and identifies with that. He is then no longer determined by mood. If we watch ourselves very carefully, we will find a continuous conflict going on between the free and the dull, between spirit and mood. Every time we find a mood in ourselves, we will be aware that our substance is in a definite state of tension or motion. We might find a flutter or a tremor or a contraction, a pressure or a sudden sensation of heat. Whatever we can feel as a substantial sensation, we can say is mood. If we see this fact, that mood is a state of the substance, as soon as we examine ourselves and find a mood, we should say immediately, this is substantial. I should not identify with it. It is conditioned, it is determined by mass inertia and the stimulus situation. So whatever mood we have, we immediately say, what are the characteristic stimuli acting upon it? And we know that the characteristic stimuli are causing a superstress on certain aspects of the substantial memory record and bringing into consciousness visions of things horrible or pleasant, usually horrible. And the things seen, if we identify with them, have power over us because we identify with them. The consciousness itself is eternally free. But because this consciousness is this intelligence power, and because this intelligence power is actually all there is, and mood is only the substantial state, and because this substance is only the modal operations of finite power, the object of consciousness is a power operating within a circumscribed zone, and therefore constituting a substance. So what you look at when you look at a substantial state is really the state of your own power in a peculiar characteristic motion which promises you either to expand, in which case you will feel better, or it contracts and you feel worse. As soon as you feel a sensation of power rising into you, you know immediately that the stimulus has sent to a little concept inside, there is an opportunity for growth. As soon as you feel that the mood is depressive, you know that a stimulus from outside, somewhere, has hit you and roused another one which says things are going to be bad today. All these voices exist inside. They are simply the jugglings of the alphabet. But as the alphabet is juggled by continuous stimulation into new configurations, new words arise, and they resound throughout the being. This is a little game called lexicon, shuffle a pack of cards and letters on, and you all have a few, and you play them and you try to make words and so on. And a good game is messing up another fellow's words. This kind of game illustrates, as you're playing it, that you have a change of mood. Somebody is playing the game. His partner puts down a certain word, and suddenly there's a depression in the room. Nobody notices, but the word has triggered off the mood. We are not to think that we are putting too much stress upon words, conferring power upon words. Factually, the words are conferring power on us. We have no power except formulated power at the finite end. As individuals, if we have clarity of form, we have efficient power. Clarity of form is the same thing as efficient power. Obscure form, unanalyzed form, is the same thing as inefficient power. So when we increase analytical power, penetrate to the etymology of a word, understand its real meaning, at the same time we are gaining power. To gain clarity is to gain power. Have we got a quick question or two before we retire from the link stretch?
When is you say we are depressed, there's feelings of depression. This is often called by a deep breath. Why is that?
A natural reaction. To every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. As soon as the stimulus hits you, and through the ear or through the eye, maybe a perfume, maybe something you've just eaten, it stimulates the organism, it plays over a certain memory. If the memory says you are going to be restricted, the message goes below the heart level. First place to feel it is your solar plexus. It says there's going to be a terrible loss. You contract. You hold it unconsciously. You starve yourself of oxygen. Suddenly you need oxygen to get it. This is the reaction. Because of this, you can help yourself to get rid of it. As soon as you feel the depression, you will know that if you don't get hold of it, it will contract you and starve you. You deliberately breathe in fully, then concentrate on the feeling of depression, try to isolate the cause, the particular stimulus situation, and breathe out fully so that the lungs are empty. And as you're breathing out, you're saying, as a determinant, I breathe this out. As soon as you do that, you find the thing goes. On the in-breath, you say, I breathe in reflexive self-consciousness. You're using the physiological facts of the body, symbolizing them, and using the symbols to stimulate the kind of mental content you want. This way you can defeat it.
The only way you can gain the power of choice.
Well, of course, the word choice is itself a word. If people don't understand the word choice, they haven't got any. The animal that hasn't got the word choice can't choose. We can determine the behavior of the animal. We can determine the behavior of a single cell simply by putting around it pleasant and unpleasant stimuli. But if a man has got the word choice in his vocabulary and some other words to define it, he's already on the way to being able to send energy to one side or another. As you increase the number of concepts related to the idea of choice, related to the idea of freedom, and every incoming energy which can be filed into the complex of ideas to do with freedom is knocked backwards and forwards. It can't fly straight out. And then it's knocked backwards and forwards within the complex of freedom ideas. It is analyzed into its tiniest bits, and then your proper good is seen in the knocking backwards and forwards, the mechanical analysis, which is actually done by this freedom concept. So as soon as you know that freedom is itself free and done, the unconditioned condition, and it really means the ability to determine oneself. Self is free, determination is the purpose of the problem. Free is the self. Dome is the object. As soon as you know that, if you want to be free, you refer to self. If you want to dome, you refer to the situation. If you want freedom, you refer simultaneously to self and situation. But if you haven't got any such concepts, you can't even begin to approximate it. The stimulus will determine, which is why it is said that this word, this Logos, the Christ Logos of John, that word is truth and it is life. If we've got a truth about freedom, it must operate. It gets into the ear. It begins to sort out the ideas inside. It, the concept that we could be free, determines people. Even people who's quite bound, like naughty boys of 15 to secondary modern school. As soon as you say the word freedom to them, they think it means I can do what I like. Somehow that word has this power to get hold of incoming stimuli and rattle them about. In the rattling about, they see an opportunity to behave in a way they wouldn't have done without it. And this is why teachers of freedom have been put to death by governments for thousands of years. The man who went out, and the man who goes out today, if he goes out in public and recommends absolutely individual self-determination, comes up against immediately a large number of governmental measures. The man who in the last war recommended not pacifist objection, but complete self-determination, refusal to be conscripted, had to be arrested. The government had to act quickly with those who could make it quite clear why a man should be self-determined, because only one good spokesman in a public square could cause several hundred people in one day to think that they don't need to be conscripted. The men who are conscripted are merely men. Why are those men over there sending those men over here to a place they don't want to go? Why are those men over there taking these men from their wives and children, which they feel they ought to be supporting, and the children which they ought to be bringing up, and educating and controlling, and the wives that they ought to be loving? Why do these men over there say to these men, leave your wives and go and throw bombs at those men over there? Why do they do it? The answer is, they do it. They have a tradition that they can do it. They have got away with it for a long time. Today, they have to be very, very careful about how they go about it. Because today, through fear of nuclear weapons, people are beginning to think that freedom might be better than death. It probably is. This causes a reaction against certain heavy-handed governmental measures. If we accept that there are about between 10,000 and 20,000 nuclear bombs hidden at strategic points all over the world waiting to be dropped, and simultaneously there are a few nuclear submarines, each loaded with 16 super bombs to throw about the place, in the statement the Americans made. One sub carries enough explosive to do as much damage as the whole of the last war. When people hear that, they think, it's time somebody did something about it. Now, most people wait for that somebody to come and do something about it. But this idea, time somebody should do something about it, is not a slave idea. It's an idea that men should be self-determined. And they won't be self-determined unless the stimulus comes all the time. Christ presented the original stimulus, macrocosmically. He repeated it in the crucifixion in time. He'll come with a hammer the next time and tap a bit harder, and there'll be a general sorting out. The fact is that the idea of the Logos, of the truth, penetrates into individuals, stimulates them, and brings into awareness that they are free beings, as valid as any other being. That no human being absolutely has a right to dictate to another human being. This breeds inside freedom concepts until finally a man just refuses to do what another man tells him. Is Macmillan a superman? Does he look like one? Yet if he signs on a piece of paper, will immediately several hundred thousand men be taken over there and blown to bits? The answer is yes, unless a stimulus hits them from somewhere other than Macmillan. So when we know this for the fact that a group of men, they are called power mad, we can really call them something else. They are determined by concepts of power over which they have no control. These concepts of power file into them. I know file into Alexander the Great by his dear mother who didn't like his father. These things file in when they get their dinners and the energy out of deadliness, and it plays over those clouding ideas, then they run about, nor do people about. Other people with less energy, impinged on the ear by these stimuli, respond at a lower level. Spinoza said, if you have adequate ideas, then you will be positive. If you have inadequate ideas, you will be negative. If we think about it, we will find that's perfectly true. Shall we return?